Get back in the tank.
What for?
Because I said so.
We're going home, sir.
In the tank.
Why can't we go home in a fucking helicopter?
Because you're tankers.
After destroying an Afghan village, Soviet soldiers try to outrun the Mujahideen fighters that are on their trail. This week, we chat about the definition of a flop, a not-so-scary notebook, and what RPG really stands for. Then we find out if the beast stands the test of time.
James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today? James says Gladiator with a glut. Alan says as a father, blah blah. It's the test of time. James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today? Test of time. James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Test of Time podcast. My name is Alan Noah, and joining me is the incredible, the wonderful, the handsome, I'm going to say the sexy beast, not necessarily the beast of war, though, James Brief.
Well, I'll take that intro. Thank you very much. And I'll just say, Al.
Thanks? Jeez, I go to all that trouble to say such nice things about you.
Paul Simon had a whole song, You Can Call Me Al.
Of course I like that song. Clearly I am biased. But, James, this is it. We have come to the final episode of our fan request trilogy. We started off talking about Crocodile Dundee, which was requested by Cody Jones over on Facebook. Then we reviewed The Outsiders, which came to us from Michelle D on Twitter. And today we are talking about a movie that was emailed to us by a listener named Nick Paticcio. I hope I'm saying that right. And it's a movie called The Beast, or maybe The Beast of War. I think I'm going to go with The Beast as its official title. On IMDb, it's listed as The Beast of War, but then there's a movie poster that says The Beast. And when I watched the movie on Amazon Prime, they called it The Beast. The credits in the movie called it The Beast. So I think I'm going with The Beast.
This film, whatever it's called, it's interesting because this is a film I had never heard of, either name, and I probably would never have heard of had it not been for the interaction of one of our listeners, in this case, Nick Paticcio. And I can probably say with a pretty good amount of certainty that had it not been for this podcast or had it not been for Nick, I probably would never have seen this film in my entire life.
Right. I think that's fair to say for me as well. In his email, Nick said, I've been desperately trying to convince everyone across movie fandom to give this movie a shot and hopefully drag it out of complete obscurity. And the reason that this movie has been in complete obscurity is because, Nick said, it was only released on 2 screens in the entire United States, in 2 theaters. So a movie that gets that limited of a release is probably not going to be all that well known. And Nick made an impassioned case for us to review this movie. And while we're doing listener requests, we had to do it. And I'm excited to talk about this movie. I really didn't know anything about it. Nick sent the trailer, which I watched. And all I really got from that was that it's a war movie based around a tank. So for anyone who is not familiar with this movie, it takes place during the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. A Russian tank unit, led by the crazed commander Daskal, destroys an Afghan village, and the locals vow revenge. Daskal's tank gets lost in a valley, and he turns against his own men. When tank driver Konstantin Kovarchenko refuses to follow the commander's increasingly violent orders, he is abandoned and left to die. Ultimately, Konstantin joins the Mujahideen rebels in their mission to destroy the Soviet tank. And like I said earlier, because this movie was only released on 2 screens, I've got to assume that it was a pretty big flop, right?
You know, it's interesting. You say, was this movie a flop? And when you think of a flop, I think of these big flops like it cost $10 million and only made two. Or like a few years ago, The Lone Ranger, it cost $200 million to make a big deal of it and it made a fraction of what it cost. But this film, apparently from what I read on IMDb, it was shuffled around in the Columbia Studios and there were different studio heads that came and went and the new studio head didn't really believe in the film, so we just put it in a theater in LA and New York. And so the film only made $170,000 on those two screens, which is actually pretty good. That being said, is it really a flop if a film is never really released?
That is fair. If you're calling a movie a flop based on it didn't make its money back, then yes, this movie is a flop. But if you're saying it didn't meet expectations when it had every chance to meet those expectations, then you can't really classify this movie as a flop because it was kneecapped from the get-go. The movie cost $8 million. You put it on two screens. Yeah, even if those are the two biggest movie theaters in the country, it's not going to make its money back. You know, I yell at my kids when they use this phrase, but it's not fair. You know, like it's really not fair to call the movie a flop at that point.
You know, when you say it's a flop, you always say, oh, it's a problem with the movie itself or the marketing or, you know, something messed up or, you know, you made the movie and then it happened to be starring Kevin Spacey and then that happened. But this film just never existed. It's just weird.
Right, right. And the movie starts with this brutal attack on an Afghan village. These guys roll in on a tank and they shoot everything. They destroy houses. They kill animals. They go over to a well and dump poison in it. They're knocking down every building. They are deliberately decimating this village. This is not like, oh, there's maybe one or two rebels hanging out in this village and we've got to find them. No, no. They are trying to level this village and make sure that no one can ever live there ever again. It is horrifically violent and brutal.
Oh, yeah. And this is based on the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. That it was a conflict that was about a decade long from 1979 to 1989. In the late 70s, some Soviet-backed communist parties, they took over power in the capital of Afghanistan. And they initiated a lot of modernization initiatives. And, you know, in some ways, these were very good. It brought Afghanistan, which was a very primitive country. It brought a lot of modern 20th century technologies there that were very helpful, but also, you know, brought a lot of other things that the people in the rural villages really did not appreciate because this was the Afghanistan of their ancestors, their grandfather's father's father's father. They didn't want to see a coffee shop or whatever was coming in the 70s or a disco or roller skates or women in miniskirts. They didn't want to see this stuff. So they were very against this party, and the Soviets came in and they basically went to wipe out these people in the rural areas. And what they did is they really actively instilled terror campaigns to actually kill these people and not just to, you know, kill some of the men in the village. It was to instill terror. This is what happens when you mess with the Soviets. And the commander of this tank, he's so brutal that he takes one of the leaders of this village and he puts this man under the treads of the tank. And even though the women of the village and all these villagers are begging for his life, and even the soldiers in the tank are kind of second-guessing him, he says, run this man over. And he basically turns the leader of this village into mincemeat in front of everyone. It's terrible.
Right. And the driver of the tank, Konstantin, is really hesitant to do this, but he ultimately does follow the order. He does it in front of the man's fiance. Ultimately, the tank sort of drives off, ends up going into this valley nearby, which is apparently a one-way-in, one-way-out kind of a valley. They don't realize that. They've kind of made a wrong turn. But back at the village, the now leader of this village, now that so many of the other people have been killed, was the brother of the man who was run over by the tank. His name is Taj, and he's devastated by what happened. His cousin comes over, and his cousin is like this military leader, and clearly there's a feud between them. They don't get along. They don't see eye to eye. But they decide to join forces to get revenge on the people who did this to their town, who did this to their family. And the thing that they have, their ace in the hole, is an RPG. They feel that they can destroy this tank by shooting it with this RPG, which is a rocket-propelled grenade, not a role-playing game, which is definitely what you were thinking of, James.
RPG actually does not stand for rocket-propelled grenade.
What?
This is true. That is a backronym. You know what a backronym is?
No.
A backronym is something that you make up later on. It's Russian for, and I'm going to get this totally wrong, but Rushnoy Protivoknyvy Grantomyot, which is RPG. And in English, they called them RPGs, which was for the Russian abbreviation. And then they backronym made it, oh, it actually stands for rocket-propelled grenade.
Oh, okay. Well, I did not know that. Thank you for teaching me about rocket-propelled grenades.
Okay, then.
So now, basically, the movie becomes this cat-and-mouse game where the Mujahideen fighters are trailing this tank and trying to blow it up, and the guys in the tank are trying to prevent that from happening. And along with the Russian soldiers is this man named Samad, and he is an Afghani man, and he's with them basically because he believes that the Soviets are there to help the country and modernize the country, like you were saying earlier, and he wants to be a part of that future. He feels that he's a patriot and not a traitor. But Daskal, the Russian commander, looks at Samad as a traitor, and you could imagine that other Afghanis consider him a traitor too, but he basically feels like he's doing the right thing. And Samad and Constantine one night are having this conversation about the virtues of his people. And this is known as the Pashtunwali. And I may be pronouncing that wrong, and I may be pronouncing a lot of these words wrong, so forgive me. But the three key components are Melmistia, which means being a good host, Badal, which is revenge, and Nanawate, which means giving asylum. And Constantine is asking Samad about this Nanawate concept. Like, if someone who is your enemy asks for asylum, would you still have to grant it? And Samad says, yes. Even if he is your enemy, you would still have to clothe him and feed him and protect him if this man asks for Nanawate. And that is a very important concept. And in fact, this movie is based on a play that was called Nanawate.
It's rumored that even Osama bin Laden had invoked this Nanawate in the rural parts of Afghanistan to house him. This actually also reminded me a lot, actually, of a movie like Pirates of the Caribbean. Do you remember the first one when they say parley and then the pirates right. have to kind of bring them with them? It's kind of the same concept here.
I don't remember a ton of that movie, but yes, I do remember that thing. And while Samad and Constantine are having this deep conversation about Nanawate and other things, their tank is ambushed by the Mujahideen fighters. And in the ensuing melee, while the Russians are fleeing, they leave behind all of their food, a lot of their water. They end up being surrounded by some creatures that they assume are the soldiers that followed them into the night, and they open fire, they waste a ton of ammo, and they kill everything except it wasn't people, it wasn't the Mujahideen, it was just some deer.
I did love the part of this scene that showed this advanced Soviet technology, and they had put some kind of markers down, and you just saw two dozen little lights light up on just a black screen, and the guy's like pointing, there's 25 of them. Today it would have been, you know, it would have been night vision, you would have seen what was outside, but I guess this works better because it turns out that they totally messed up. They thought they were killing 25 rebels, but they were killing just a bunch of deer.
Right. And they find out that it was deer because Daskal sends Samad out to investigate and, you know, make sure that all the bad guys are dead. And while Samad is out of the tank, Daskal orders Constantine to kill Samad. And remember, earlier in the movie, Daskal ordered Constantine to run over that guy with the tank, and Constantine didn't want to do it, but he did. In this case, Constantine says no. He refuses to shoot Samad because Samad is his friend. He is helping them, and he just refuses to do it, which is ostensibly the right thing to do, but obviously this infuriates Daskal.
Yeah, he had also talked to Samad earlier, and he was talking to him about running that guy over, and Samad had asked him, why did you do it? And he said, I had no choice. And Samad explained to him, you always have a choice. I mean, even if it costs you your life, you have a choice. So you don't have to kill someone. So later on, he decides, yeah, even though it's it very well can kill him, he doesn't have to listen to his commander. And this commander, I mean, he is totally losing it, this guy. He orders at one point Samad to get out of the tank, and he says, go in the river, I want to see how deep it is. And Samad takes a few steps in the river, and the commander just kills him point-blank range, just, cold-blooded murder.
Right. And Constantine is furious, and he yells at him, and you can't do that, and you're not allowed to murder your own men. And then he takes out this notebook, and he starts writing it down, and he's right to be angry, and he's right to say that he's going to report his commander for doing this, but him, like, writing it down in this notebook, it just felt very, like, weak. It felt like, ooh, how scary, you're writing it down in your little book. Like, so what? This guy is clearly unhinged. He just murdered one of his own men, and you're threatening him with a notebook? Like, that's not so scary.
Right, right. And he shows him the notebook. They're inside a tin can in the middle of the desert. Like, not a good move.
Right. And basically, the next time that Constantine pisses off the commander, which is only, you know, a couple of minutes later, the commander says, you know what? I've had it. Constantine is a traitor. And he gets the other two guys to tie Constantine to a rock and effectively leave him to die. They also put a grenade under his head as like a booby trap, which I didn't really get, like, how that was a booby trap. It looks like they pull the pin on the grenade, so if he lifts up his head, then the grenade will explode.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Or if he just dies from exposure, when the Mujahideen come to look at his body, they'll also be booby trapped.
Ah, okay. I guess that makes sense. But it's not the main group of Mujahideen that find Constantine. First, it's a pack of wolves that are attacking him and trying to eat him, you know, from below. And Constantine lifts up his head. The grenade rolls down quickly and blows up the wolves. But then these women find him. And it's these women from the village, including the fiance of the man who was run over by the tank. And she's leading this group of women. They all start throwing rocks at him. And then the men fighters come across the scene, and Constantine claims Nanawate. He asks for asylum. And Taj, who is the leader of the Mujahideen, kind of feels like, yeah, we have to grant him asylum. If we don't, we're no better than the people who we are fighting against.
Yes, so Constantine goes with them, and I think there's a great scene at night. They're in a cave, and they're making a fire, which I thought was very clever, because I always thought it was stupid how the Soviet guys were making fires in the middle of the canyon, and like, you could totally be seen, but these guys are making a fire in a cave, and while they're in the cave, these guys have no way of communicating, and I thought it was very good that Constantine doesn't learn how to speak their language by the end of the film. But they wind up making a very simple sentence. They find out his name, Constantine, tank, they learn this word, and then they learn kaboom for explosion. And then the leader of the tribe, he says, Constantine, kaboom, tank.
Exactly, and they're communicating as best they can, and clearly some of the Mujahideen are skeptical of Constantine because he's a Russian. They don't like the Russians. They recognize him from the tank attack in the beginning of the movie, but also, on the other hand, he was strapped to rocks and left to die. So it's kind of a the enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of a deal. And Constantine proves that he's on board with them when he fixes their RPG. It's not working. He says he's going to fix it. A couple of the guys are like, he's not going to fix it. He's not going to fix it. But he does. So he's really showing that, yeah, I hate these guys. I want to kill them. I want to blow up the tank with you. And they are effectively on the same team. Meanwhile, the guys in the tank think that they're getting out of this valley. They think they're almost at Kandahar Road, and they technically kind of are, except they can't get to Kandahar Road because there is a giant ravine in front of them that was not on their map. Part of their map is burnt, so they didn't see that there was a ravine in front of them. And the Russians realize what the Afghanis had said to each other and us, the audience, earlier in the movie, that this valley has one way in, one way out. They are stuck. They think they are going to die when suddenly a helicopter appears, a Russian chopper, and these guys are saved. They are free. Not Daskal, but the other two men, Kaminsky and Golikov. They run to the chopper. They're so excited. They're like, yay, we're saved. Hooray. And one of the other guys on the chopper says, yeah, get on board. We'll fly you over to base and, you know, we'll just blow up the tank. And Daskal says, no, we do not do that. You do not destroy my tanks. We're going to drive this tank out of here.
Yeah, and, you know, we learn a lot about this guy and, you know, his origins. Remember, this is the 80s. So this guy, he's in his late 50s, maybe early 60s, and he has been fighting tanks. Says he was a child fighting the Nazis. And, you know, there's one thing about being a POW in World War II. If you're going to be a Nazi POW, meaning you're an actual Nazi being captured, you definitely want to be captured by the Western Allies. You did not want to be captured by the Soviets because these guys were not given trials and, you know, maybe a merciful hanging in which, you know, they had a couple seconds of pain. No, no, no. The Russians, they were brutal to these people who were horribly brutal to them first. I have to imagine that this guy, even though you could say he was on the good guy team and you know, fighting the Nazis, this guy, when he was 8 years old, he saw some shit. And then this guy says, not only was he in this tank war, but then he went into Czechoslovakia, this one, and Siberia, and this war. And you could just tell that this was one Soviet brutal tanked army after another.
Yeah, I mean, it's cool that we get this backstory on Daskal and we understand where he's coming from, and it does not justify his behavior at all. Like, he's clearly lost it. He's a sociopath, but it is cool that they provide that background and you get to understand why he is so obsessed with his tank.
Right. It doesn't justify it. It explains it.
Right. Exactly. And you feel for these other two guys who are stuck with him as they're like ordered off of the helicopter to go with him. I sort of was imagining that one of the guys was going to shoot him in the back so they wouldn't have to go with him, but they couldn't really do that because they were surrounded by these other Russian soldiers. They don't know these guys. You know, like, you don't shoot your commanding officer in front of other officers. That's just a bad idea.
Right, and they also couldn't refuse to follow his orders. One of the guys asked the other, like, why didn't we just stay on the helicopter? And he goes, he would have blown us out of the sky. And this guy totally would have done it. He would have said, you broke a Soviet commanding officer's law. You are sentenced to death. I'm blowing up this helicopter. It sucks there's other soldiers, but, you know, they're martyrs for the greater Soviet good.
Right, you could totally see that. So Daskal and his two other men go back in the tank, they refuel, and they stop later on to refuel again. The helicopter is there again. The helicopter stopped to, I think, drop off more fuel for them and also to get a drink of water at this watering hole. We didn't mention that earlier in the movie, Daskal and his men poisoned this watering hole as a way to kill some of the Mujahideen that were following them. It worked then. They killed one of their men, but now they inadvertently killed their own men because these Russian soldiers who were on the helicopter stopped, landed, said, hey, free water, we're thirsty, and they got some water and they all died. So Then, just as the Skull and his men find their dead comrades, along comes the Mujahideen, and they are ready to go. Constantine is angry. He's firing at them, and the guys in the tank basically have to leave. And then half of the Mujahideen are like, hey, instead of going after that tank, look at this brand new helicopter we just found that is filled with supplies, and all of the guys on it are dead, and we just hit, like, the ultimate jackpot.
Oh, yeah, this thing is fully gassed up. The keys are literally in the ignition, and it's theirs for the taking. I mean, this is a $300 million piece of military equipment that they found. This guy is now the king of his province in Afghanistan.
I think he even says, like, Allah has been extra kind to us today or something like that. But for Constantine and Taj, they are not interested in this helicopter. They want revenge. So they go after the tank. They get to this pass, which is this narrow place that the tank has to go through to get out of the valley. They have the high ground, which seemed like the perfect place to shoot the tank with the RPG, but for some reason they don't. They end up going back down to the ground to shoot it. I didn't really get why they left the high ground.
My only guess with the reason why they were on ground level is I would imagine that the strongest part of a tank is the armor on the top. And my guess is that really the way to incapacitate a tank is you have to blow up the tread somehow. You have to make this thing immobile. And I think you have to fire from the ground level to fire on its side rather than firing from above. That's my guess.
Okay, that makes sense. I can buy that. But at one point, Constantine's ready to fire, but he doesn't have the rocket. So Taj has to, like, toss him the rocket from the other side of this pass, which I was like, that's not good. Like, you don't want to have a catch with a live rocket, right? I mean, like, that seems like a bad idea.
Oh, yeah, that was crazy.
But Constantine has his one shot with the RPG, and he hits the tank, but only in the turret. So the tank is still functional. It's still okay. And Constantine missed. He blew it. But then, out of nowhere, these rocks come tumbling down from above and land on the tank, immobilize it. And you're like, wait, what happened? Where did these rocks come from? I thought it was the guys in the helicopter who had showed up and just started firing, but it's not. It's the women from the village who we saw earlier had a couple of grenades, and they blow up part of this cliff and send the boulder down. And they'd also been talking earlier about how these warriors against the tank were sort of like David versus Goliath. And David defeated Goliath with just a rock. So here, these warriors defeat the tank with a rock. I mean, it's more than just a rock. It's a giant boulder, but still, you know, the metaphor tracks.
Yeah, I do see that. And the tank is incapacitated. And this is the point when the commander realizes they're totally done. So he basically says, we're going to booby trap ourselves, and they're going to come in. We're all going to blow up, and we're going to take them with us. And the other guys are like, fuck you. Now they've decided this is the point when we do mutiny. And there's a big fight in the tank. The commander has taken out a grenade, taken the pin out, and they actually wrestle him, and they do successfully put the pin back in the grenade. I was surprised about this. I was certain that you were just going to see the tank blow up from the inside, you know, a shot from the exterior. But they manage to secure the pin in again, and all three of them escape. And Constantine sees that the Mujahideen are about to kill them all, justifiably. These guys killed their whole village. And Constantine, he asks for Nanawate, the mercy, on behalf of his Soviet comrades.
Right. And you can sort of understand why he wants to protect Golikov and Kaminsky. Kaminsky was more of a jerk. Golikov, he kind of got along with better. But Daskal, like, the guy was a madman. But Constantine says, I want you to see Russia lose this war. I want you to see how, yeah, you used to fight the Nazis, but now you are the Nazi. We are the bad guys, and I want you to witness this. And he lets the three of them go, and Taj is kind of surprised by this, but he's kind of going along with it. But the women warriors, the ones who knocked the boulder out of the sky, yeah, they're not feeling so merciful. They let the two other guys go, but Descal, they stoned to death. And you can't feel bad for him.
Oh, he got what was coming to him. And then, a Soviet helicopter shows up. And they simply lower one of those rescue buoys. You know, like when someone's trapped in the ocean and they just lower that rope in and they tie it around their waist and they just lift themselves up. He gets lifted up and the other two guys, they're kind of, you assume they're running on foot to the Kandahar Road and they'll be picked up by some transport at some point. But the movie ends with an aerial shot of Konstantin flying away, hanging below the helicopter.
That's right. And I have to say, whenever I see something like that in a movie, I think to myself, that looks kind of fun. And obviously, I'm sure it's terrifying. And, you know, being airlifted out of a war-torn country, it's probably not that much fun. I'm sure if I was ever in a situation like that, I would be freaking the fuck out. But I don't know. It just does kind of look a little bit like fun.
Well, you and I did once hang off the side of an airplane and then jump out.
We didn't hang off. We just jumped right out. Actually, we kind of rolled more out.
No, we sat on the edge, let our feet like dangle outside for several seconds, and then we just leaned forward. But it's not the same thing as being airlifted out of a helicopter canopy.
No. We're referring to the time we went skydiving, by the way, in case that wasn't clear. For my bachelor party, we went skydiving, and that was a good time.
Don't spoil it. I think they had lots of several ideas of how we could have jumped out of an airplane that wasn't skydiving, Al. Why'd you spoil that?
Sorry. Well, anyway, we've come to the end of this movie. So, James, do you think that the Beast, / the Beast of War, stands the test of time?
Well, I'm going to say there's a lot of things I like about this film. But I'm going to start with a couple things that didn't totally work for me. You know, have you ever seen The Hunt for Red October, Al?
I have not.
Oh, well, I'm sure we'll watch it soon, certainly in memory of the late Sir Sean Connery. But in that film, it's in a Soviet sub, and everyone on the sub is speaking Russian. So in the beginning of the film, we see all the people speaking Russian, there's subtitles on the bottom, and I believe we even see Sir Connery. I believe he's also speaking Russian. Now, the film is not all in Russian. Now, what happens is Sean Connery is speaking Russian, and the camera zooms in on his lips and he's saying something Russian, 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 and it just kind of morphs into him speaking English, and the camera like pans back out to everyone, and from then on everyone in the sub is speaking English, but it's kind of a wink to the audience, like, hey everyone, we're not going to do a subtitle film, but everyone here is really speaking Russian. But for the ease of you, they're going to speak English. And in this film, the Afghan people, they all speak their native language and there's subtitles. But the Soviet soldiers, they speak English.
Mm-hmm.
And they speak American English. And not only that, but the two big stars, one is Jason Patrick. You know, he was a big star. We've reviewed him before in The Lost Boys. It also stars Stephen Baldwin, who's one of the Baldwin brothers. And he kind of has this, like, bowl cut of the 90s, even though it's the late 80s here. He's kind of blonde, and he's incredibly American-looking. And it works after a while, but in the beginning, it is a little bit confusing. It didn't need to be a subtitle film, and I certainly didn't need to see Stephen Baldwin either speaking Russian or speaking with fake Russian accent. I didn't need any of that, but I wanted something that was more obvious, that these were the Soviets. But that being said, I watched this film yesterday, and I was thinking about this film a lot today. It really isn't a war film. I mean, this genre has been done before. You know, people are kind of, they're stranded, and the locals are out to get them. In this particular case, the locals are kind of the good guys seeking revenge, but I like what you said before. It's a cat and mouse game. If it's a film made today, I feel like there would have been like 9 people in the tank, so you can slowly pick them off one at a time. Except for Samad, who's murdered outright. Nobody's really picked off, and it's very tense. It's a good length. It's like, what was it, like an hour and 45 minutes or something?
Hour 50.
Yeah, something like that. It's one of the rare films, I'd say. It's about as long as it needs to be. It didn't need another 20 minutes of another couple adventures of, you know, back and forth cat and mouse. But I think the film is very well acted. It's directed by Kevin Reynolds. We've liked one of his films so far. That was Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. Lo and behold, I like this film. So I'm going to say The Beast of War, no matter what you call this film stands the test of time. And, you know, another final thing is that Constantine, he tells the commander he wants him to live because he wants him to see the end of this futile Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And the Soviets don't lose this war for another couple years, assuming this film was filmed in like 86, 87 and released in 88. That stood the test of time. That certainly wars in Afghanistan are not really wars that you can win. What do you think, Al? What does and does not stand the test of time?
Well, I 1,000% agree with you on the whole thing about these guys are Russians, but they're Americans speaking English. Like, I got it pretty quickly in the movie, but at first, in the very beginning, I'm like, wait, are they Americans that all just have Russian names? No, okay, they're Russians. I guess you could make the argument that, well, Americans and Russians are predominantly Caucasian, so maybe you could get away with it in terms of looks, but that doesn't really work when one of the guys is a fucking Baldwin brother. I mean, Stephen Baldwin, like all of the Baldwins, are, like me, from Long Island. And Long Island is awesome. It's great. We are wonderful people. But we're not Russian. And it's just weird seeing Americans pretending to be Russians who speak English. Like, it's just jarring. It is bizarre. And part of me wonders if that was why this movie got kicked around from one executive to another executive and then ended up being released only in two movie theaters. Maybe that had something to do with it, of like, what's the audience going to be for this movie? We're making the Russians kind of sympathetic. They're like the bad guys, but also our hero is a Russian and he's a bad guy turned good. But we in America consider the Russians bad guys, but also these Russians are Americans who speak English. And are people going to be confused? Because I'm already getting confused explaining this, and let's just put it on two theaters and forget about it. Like, I don't know if that's what really happened, but I could see that. I could imagine that conversation happening at Columbia Pictures. Side note, Taj, the Afghan character, is played by Stephen Bauer, who is Cuban. Samad is played by Eric Avari, who is Indian, not Afghani. He, by the way, might be the most famous person in this movie. Did you recognize him from other things?
No. What's he been in?
Well, he has been in a handful of movies. He's in Stargate, which is a movie we'll definitely review at some point. He was in Independence Day. He was on Heroes, I believe, the first season, like the good season of that show. The Mummy, he was in The Mummy, which we saw. And also Mr. Deeds, apparently. I don't really remember all that much about that movie. So he's been around. He's done a lot of stuff. But I mean, overall, I do think the casting is weird. It would have made more sense if this movie was effectively entirely subtitled with the guy speaking Pashto, I believe is the name of the language in Afghanistan, as well as Russian, but that would have been maybe not so appetizing for an American audience. So I get it. I get why they did it. All that said, this is a really entertaining movie. This is about the horrors of war. It's about what the horrors of war do to people. If you've ever seen Apocalypse Now, you can see how a military commander can go crazy. I mean, this is a thing that can happen. Good people follow horrible orders and it haunts them. And then maybe they make some right choices later. This movie is about a war that maybe not all Americans are super familiar with, the Russians invading Afghanistan. But you can easily imagine these story beats taking place in any war, really. And I'm going to agree with you, James. I'm going to say that this movie does stand the test of time. So finally, a movie that was requested by our fans, we do think stands the test of time. Thank you, Nick Paticcio, for recommending this movie. Yes, The Beast / The Beast of War does stand the test of time. Woohoo!
I did enjoy watching the other two films. I just said that they didn't stand the test of time.
I know. I just feel like it's a nicer ending. It's a nicer way to round out this trilogy of fan request episodes to say yes. That's not why we said yes, of course. But that's going to do it for this week's episode. Come back next week when we will be talking about Field of Dreams with a very special guest, comedian Steve Hofstetter. Yeah, very, very cool. Steve Hofstetter is a very funny comedian, and he's going to be dropping by the show to talk about one of his favorite movies, Field of Dreams. Baseball, Kevin Costner, James Earl Jones. It is streaming on Peacock, if anyone wants to check out this movie ahead of that episode. And like I always say, talk to us at Test of Time Pod on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Email us, thetestoftimepodcast@gmail.com. You can send us requests. You can send us thoughts, critiques, criticisms, complaints about James. That would probably be fine. Whatever you want to say, we're here. We're listening. And yeah, we'll see you next week, everybody.
Bye.